The following is an Auburn Network production.
You are on the line. Live on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader. Online at ESPNAU.com or on the ESPN 106.7 app. To be on the line, call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502. You are on the line with Jacob Goetz.
You're on the line here on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika sports leader. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope you're doing well on this September 3rd, 2024. This is On the Line, the show that tells you like it is and holds nothing back. I'm your man, Jacob Goetz, with you for the next 2 hours right here on ESPN 106.7. And man, it's going to be a great show today. Yesterday was a lot of fun recapping a lot of week one around college football. But man, we have more of that to talk about today, more reactions for Auburn. And the AP poll is out today. After week one, some surprises in there, in my opinion. So we'll have a lot of that coming up for you in hour number two. Buddy joins us every Tuesday, lots of Fridays as well. Christian Griffin in the studio, voice of Lee Scott. What's up, my man? Good to see you.
Welcome back to On the Line. It's a great day to be here. Great Tuesday. I get to come in and talk about how I was the only one that projected USC to beat LSU, but we'll wait for hour number two for that one.
Whatever.
Just had to go ahead and let you know about it as soon as I got in.
That's fine. I'm the only one that said it was a low-scoring affair where the defenses would shine, but that's, you know, that is what it is.
That's okay. Fine. You have to be right, too. We'll give you sympathy clap.
I do.
Okay.
I do have to be. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not right much, so when I am right, I gotta scream it from the rooftops a little bit. But we'll get to all of our football stuff coming up in hour number two, because on Tuesdays in hour number one, if you're new around here, well, we appreciate you being here, and we're joined by Lindsey Crosby in the studio for our baseball power hour. Lots to get to on the baseball side of things. Lindsey, good to have you back, my friend.
Hey, it is always great to be here. I am excited to talk some ball.
Are you?
A lot of stuff happened over the weekend.
A lot happened over the weekend around Major League Baseball. We normally talk a little Auburn baseball if there is some, but at this point, there's just not a whole lot on that side of things. And exactly. So we're going to stick with the Braves. We're going to stick with Major League Baseball here in hour number one. Phone lines are open today. We'd love for you to be a part of the show. 334-321-1390. That number again, 334-321-1390. You can call in talking baseball. If you have questions, comments, concerns, I'm sure you do, you can be a part of the show that way. Or you can just get us a text or shoot us a text in the On the Line text box at 334-784-1067. And we normally start with the Braves, and that's where we will start again today, coming off of a very important series in Philadelphia. Wasn't the worst outcome, but it wasn't really the best outcome either.
Yeah, Atlanta wins one game out of the three, and arguably it was just a few specific situations away from being 3-1 as far as a series win. And a lot of the attention on that Sunday loss particularly went to pitching decisions, pitching moves or lack of pitching moves. And I think that kind of obscures maybe just how rough that weekend was for the Braves. But definitely some interesting strategic decisions about when to go to the bullpen or not go to the bullpen, and when to go ahead and what pitches to throw to what guys. So interesting weekend for the Atlanta Braves, but ultimately a frustrating one because they go 1-3.
I saw the biggest thing that you talked about was that 0-2 pitch that Schwellenbach had to Nick Castellanos, the guy that's known for especially chasing the slow stuff. Just missed his spot. I agree with what you said on X, where if he hits his spot, I think it's the correct pitch, but instead falls back over the plate, turns into a two-run double, and it feels like, as you were mentioning, it's just one or two pitches here and there that completely shift that series from a 1-3 record to a 3-1 record, where rather than trying to stay afloat, you're almost right back into the driver's seat.
Exactly. The catcher set up down and away. Travis Arnold set up down and away, kind of the outside corner there, and the slider ends up middle in. And when you rewatch the at-bat, and a lot of Braves fans were mad that Schwellenbach was left in the game in the first place.
Yeah.
He had just given up two hits to Trey Turner and Bryce Harper, so he's now in the game to face Nick Castellanos for a third time versus going to the bullpen. but the slider just kind of spins out of his hand. Like, he never has it out of the hand, and so misses by the width of the plate and obviously up a little bit, and Castellanos rips the double. And that got a lot of the attention, but it was still two runs allowed over six innings. Like, it still wasn't a death sentence here. And the other decision was to take out Aaron Bummer for Grant Holmes in the 11th inning to face Castellanos again. And it's a situation I wrote, I wrote an analysis piece early on, I think on Sunday morning, about Aaron Bummer needed to be used more in high leverage situations. Sidearm, lefty, funky, you know, sinker slider kind of guy. But he's literally the best pitcher in baseball at not allowing barrels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has one allowed barrel all year. Came in Colorado. Things in Colorado are always weird. He is borderline elite at not allowing hard contact. He is among the best in baseball at not allowing, at inducing ground balls, over 60%. And so with runners on second and third and two outs, you want the ground ball guy. And Atlanta goes away from the lefty Aaron Bummer against Castellanos, which is a left-on-right matchup. They go away from that to go to Grant Holmes, who is right-on-right. And I think that was a strategic mistake because Aaron Bummer's batting average allowed to lefties and righties was 5 points different at the time. Like, all, virtually the same.
Right.
And it feels like the worst-case scenario here is a line drive to the outfield, right? Like, that's the last thing you want because that's your walk-off. And they go to Grant Holmes. Grant Holmes opens up with a fastball kind of way, like very top of the zone. Castellanos is taken the whole time. After that, he throws two sliders practically in the dirt, and Castellanos swings on both of them. And you're like, okay, you're now up 1-2 in the at-bat, and he throws him a fastball in the middle of the zone. Walk-off hit, Phillies win. It's the second time that Grant Holmes has thrown a middle fastball to Nick Castellanos in that series. He gave up a home run on that exact same pitch in the seventh inning on Thursday or Friday, one of those two. And so the dichotomy of not making the pitching change when people felt you should in the sixth, and then making the pitching change when you didn't need to in the 11th, lost Atlanta that game. But let's ignore the fact that the Braves put up two runs. They had the leadoff runner on in every inning after that sixth inning and never once brought them in.
Which is, I think, a bigger problem than the pitching situation, if you ask me, because we know Atlanta, like, yeah, they've got pitching, but they thrive on their offense. They win games based off of hitting and scoring.
And that's the night after throwing up a goose egg.
Yeah.
The entire, all nine innings.
It was 20 innings with two total runs the final two games of the series. And I got to go back to look to see exactly what innings Atlanta scored in on Saturday. I want to say it was the seventh inning. So that's 22 consecutive innings where they put up a total of two runs.
Gosh.
And, like, that's why they lost. Yeah, they had 13 runs for the series, but 11 of those were in the first two games. And they still only won one of those. So
it's so crazy because baseball, we all know, right? We all watch it, live it, breathe it every day. Mm-hmm. But we all know that it comes down to just a couple of pitches more times than not in a game. But especially right now, end of August, early September, where not only are the Braves trying to catch up with the Mets and keep their streak alive in the NL East, or catch up with the Phillies, excuse me, they're now trying to avoid the Mets, who are trying to catch up and are right on the Braves' tail.
Yeah, and I guess the last note on this Phillies series, and Christian made the point, it was just a couple plays that went the wrong way that tilted it to Atlanta's, or to Phillies' favor, and that is what you have to deal with when you don't have a very good offense. Last season, arguably the reason Atlanta won over 100 games for the second consecutive year is they had one of the greatest offenses we've ever seen in MLB.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're on a streak of, I think, 21 or 22 consecutive starts from their pitch, from their starters, of three or less runs allowed. And yet they are falling behind in the division because the offense is not producing. And it's incredibly frustrating to be in that situation if you're Atlanta. I mean, they're 13-8 in those games. The starting pitching hasn't allowed more than three runs in any game in that stretch. But they're only 13-8 because the offense is barely producing. And when that happens, that means you are at the whims of one or two plays can ruin the whole thing for you.
I don't know if this is necessarily a question for you or if it's more so just answering what you already said statistically, but going back a couple games before the series, when Nick Castellanos was in the postgame presser, they asked him, you know, what do you look for in the plate? And he said, you know, I don't really have any sort of approach. I just see the ball and try and hit it as hard as I possibly can. So that shows the chase rate of what Castellanos has. He hunts the fastball. Looking at Grant Holmes, he throws his four-seam fastball 36.7% of the time. So one out of three pitches, you're going to see a fastball. You saw it the first time, then you saw two spike sliders. What do you think you're going to see the next time you're sitting that four-seam fastball rather than Aaron Bummer, who throws a sweeper 41% of the time, a sinker 41% of the time, a four-seam fastball 9% of the time? So just, I mean, again, I know that's not necessarily a question for you, Lindsay, but it goes right back to exactly what you were saying of a very questionable pitching change, especially against a batter such as Nick Castellanos.
Right, and I have a question on that that I can kind of give you. I mean, is this a situation, in your opinion, Lindsay, where if it works out, we praise the decision, but since it didn't work out, we're kind of harping on, like, is it that situation, or would it have been of more a, wow, we dodged a bullet, it worked out, I didn't agree when it happened, but Braves win, so it's all okay.
It's definitely a lot more visible because they lost, and I think because you had the pitching decision go wrong both times they made it when you did different things.
That's fair.
I think that highlights it. If Schwellenbach gets the out of Castellanos in the sixth inning, then I don't necessarily know if there's still an outcry about this, about Grant Holmes. I don't think it's as bad. But it's the fact that you made two different decisions and they were both wrong. I think that's why it's so loud. Now, there's people like me who try to look at the inputs and you know, the decisions right or wrong, whether or not it works out. Like, that's an important thing to remember. And we oftentimes judge these things based on the result, when in reality, leaving him in or taking him out is either right or wrong at the time you make the decision, no matter what happens, right? Like, taking Aaron Bummer out for Grant Holmes, even if Grant Holmes gets that strikeout, that was a bad decision because the matchup is much better for Bummer versus Castellanos than it is Holmes versus Castellanos. Even if you ignore the fact that Castellanos took him deep on Thursday, like, even if you ignore that, just from what they do, to Christian's point, it's a better decision to do Bummer. But I do think it is magnified by the fact that they lost and that both decisions were wrong.
That makes sense. Another question for you that I'm sure we could get to in the second segment if needed, but Raisel Iglesias just won NL Reliever of the Month, so that is a very plus for the Braves in their bullpen, where Raisel has kind of been the only guy that's had a lot of success recently. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
He went two innings. He went six outs on Sunday night, and that's not a position the Braves put him in very often. Do you have – I know we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, to where he had a six-out appearance. How many has he had since joining the Braves? Because he looked very good doing it, but it's definitely not a situation where you see him in very often.
This is the third time he's done it this season. But before this, I want to say he had only done it maybe twice.
Okay.
In, like, with the Braves since then. And it's funny. He was talking to the media after the game. You know, we have the quote from him through a translator. He was saying that he actually, or I guess Snit told us this, he asked to go back out for the 11th. He pitched the 9th and the 10th.
Oh, wow.
And then he asked to go back out for the 11th, and they said, no, you did your job. Now it's on us. And obviously they didn't do their job. They didn't score any runs. But he hadn't been used at all in the series until that final game. And so he wanted to go three. He knew it was an off day yesterday. He asked to go back out there. He threw 26 pitches to get through two innings, one walk, three strikeouts, no hits. Hell, you know, kept that Philly runner from scoring in the 10th.
Yeah.
He wanted to go back out, and they said no.
All you can ask for.
Yeah, I mean, that's
literally,
what I was...
Literally did your job.
That's what I was going to ask, was I wonder how he feels about having a little bit more usage in Atlanta, especially this year, but I think that answers the question. If he's willing to go back out, I mean, he's a winner, man. That's what he wants to be out there.
Here's a great stat here. In his last 29 and a third innings, his ERA, 0.00. He has allowed one unearned run in that entire stretch, and I believe that was a run that scored in extra innings in his first of the three two-inning appearances against Arizona. Atlanta wins 5-4. We scored two in the 10th. But he's allowed one earned run, three walks, six hits, to 35 strikeouts in that stretch.
What was the walk to strikeout ratio again? Because that's
three walks to 35 strikeouts.
Yeah, I'd say that's halfway. I think that's awarding or deserving of NL reliever of the month.
I mean, absolutely. That is literally the last time he allowed an earned run was June 16th.
Golly,
that is an absurd stretch. And this is batting average allowed in that stretch 0.066. You'll take that. An OPS of 203. Opposing batters have looked like National League starting pitchers against Raisel Iglesias for the better part of 2 months.
Was it June 6th you mentioned?
Is that the day? 16th, I think. 16th?
June 16th, yes. June 16th against the Tampa Bay Rays. He took the loss. He allowed two runs in one inning for Atlanta to drop a game in the ninth. I think they got walked off by Tampa Bay.
Hmm. Well, the relievers are doing, or he's at least doing his job, but Atlanta, they've got to give some support, especially on the offensive side. We'll talk more about that. Plus, we'll talk about the current standings as Atlanta goes 1-3 in Philly over the weekend. What happens now? What do we have next for Atlanta? What do they have to do? Not to catch the Phillies, but maybe to keep their playoff hopes alive. We'll have that for you as our Baseball Power Hour continues after this here on ESPN 106.7.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7. Call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502.
Back inside the studio here at ESPN 106.7, Baseball Power Hour. We do it every week on Tuesdays, the one true hour a week that we talk nothing but baseball. I'm Jacob Goins. Alongside of us is Christian Griffin, voice of the Lee Scott Warriors, and Lindsey Crosby, who truly makes this our Baseball Power Hour. Lindsey, tell the people how they can find you. I know there's been some things moving around, so tell the people where you are.
Yep, so I'm on Twitter at Crosby Baseball, probably the best place to find me. We've got two shows and some written work. So show number one, the Braves Today podcast, pretty much on a daily cadence now, wherever you get your podcast and on YouTube. The other show is called First Pitch. We're breaking down MLB action every single weekday morning. And then the written work at bravestoday.com that has moved from Athlon Sports. We are now independent. That's a Substack, a newsletter. That is independent. We are not tied to any of the major publishers who kind of want you to do the quantity over the quality. My guy Christian just dropped 1,800 words this afternoon looking at all of the upcoming series left in the season for the Atlanta Braves, how the Braves have done against those teams, how the Braves are doing against teams over and under 500, at home, away, all that kind of stuff. So bravestoday.substack.com, just bravestoday.com. It's all linked together.
Okay.
Go check it out there.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you always taking the time to be with us on Tuesday afternoons and talking about the Atlanta Braves and all of the different divisional races that are happening right now. And you look at the NL East, Phillies are now 7 games up. They're back to a 7-game lead after this weekend in Philly. But I think it's fair to say that should not be the Braves' concern right now. It should be the New York Mets, who have quietly become a beast right behind them, and they're a half a game back of the Braves.
There is no team in baseball that is in a winning streak of more than 2 games, except for the New York Mets. They have won their last 5, and they are 7-3 in their last 10 games, and like you said, half a game up. Now, Atlanta does have a little bit easier schedule than the Mets down the stretch. Braves fans honestly need to temporarily root for the Phillies here because the Mets have 7 games left against Philly, as well as 3 against the Milwaukee Brewers and 2 against the Red Sox, who are still trying to fight for a postseason spot.
They're trying.
And so the next to last series of the year is going to be in Atlanta. It is going to be the Mets coming to town. Ideally, you are not having to take that series to preserve your postseason spot. Ideally, the Braves' schedule appears to be pretty easy. The Mets' schedule appears to be pretty tough, but you have a half-game lead, and so you have to win your games because, yes, that's the fourth hardest schedule remaining for the Mets. Yes, it is. That is the hardest schedule among postseason contenders. Ahead of them is the Giants, the Rockies, and the Rays.
Mm-hmm.
But you're only 5-5 against the Mets. Their pitching has been surprisingly good recently. You need to You need to handle your business so that you're not having to battle them just to hold on to a postseason spot at the end of September.
And remind me and remind our listeners about how many games left for everybody at this point.
It is around...
I know not everybody's quite the same, but...
Yeah, the Mets have 24 left. Atlanta has 25 left.
Okay.
Atlanta's strength of schedule is one of the easiest in baseball. The only contender with an easier schedule than Atlanta's is the Dodgers, of course. That's Shocker. How that works. While the Mets have the hardest schedule among contenders left, 531 winning percentage for the Mets opponents. Atlanta's are only 484. You get three against the Rockies, three against the Blue Jays, four against the Reds, three against the Marlins. It's set up for you to keep your spot and go in the postseason if you can just handle your business.
Question in the on-the-line text box. You can get in on that at 334-784-1067, or you can give us a call at 334-321-1390. Question is, and it's a big one, Lindsay, and I feel like a lot of people are in this same situation. Is the division out of the question? Is the winning the division, are the Braves out of that, and is it more about getting to the playoffs than winning the division?
Mathematically, obviously, you're not out of it, right? FanGraphs, when I checked yesterday evening, they have Atlanta with a 3.1% chance of winning the division. Losing that series meant that, in essence, you have to get hot and Philly has to collapse. Like we said, that's a big lead, seven games right now. But at the same time, I don't think you have to be super concerned about winning the division. Yes, that bye is great. Teams that win the division and get a first-round bye have a 100% chance of moving on to the next round of the postseason. Breaking news.
Math.
But but last year, who made the World Series? A number 5 seed and a number 6 seed. True. So you don't have to win the division. You technically still can mathematically, but you need a lot of help. You still have a 73% chance of making the postseason because you are in a postseason spot now. Your goal should be hold off the Mets, not catch the Phillies. It could happen. I'm not saying they're gonna turn it down, but your focus has to be holding on to your spot now versus trying to chase down theirs.
And I know that Braves fans will be upset if they don't win the division because of the streak that they have. I mean, six consecutive, going for seven. And look, that is a very unrealistic run that the Braves just went on. Like, that doesn't happen historically in baseball. Like, think about how hard it is to win your division every single season, and to do it 6 years in a row, man, that's insane.
If you are frustrated about that, and it's logical that you would be, here's the two things I want to remind people of. Number one is four members of your opening day lineup by the end of the season will have not missed 2 months or more. Matt Olson, Marcelo Zuna, Orlando Arcia, and Jared Kelnick. Everybody else in that lineup has missed at least 2 months or will have by the end of the season. You also got Strider for two starts, and that's it. This is the equivalent. Imagine what Philly would look like if you took Schwarber, Harper, and Turner all out of the lineup for multiple months. They never got Schwarber back, and then they never got Zach Wheeler back either. The fact that you are in a postseason spot, honestly, is a bit miraculous.
Yeah, I agree.
There is not many organizations in baseball that would even be sniffing the postseason right now with the position player injuries that Atlanta would have. Missing more than 2 months of Ronald Acuña Jr., Austin Riley, Michael Harris, Sean Murphy, and Ozzie Albies. But I am not thinking about the division at this point. I am just trying to hold on to my postseason spot if I'm the Atlanta Braves.
And this season, realistically, could go down in the record books with an asterisk by because of all of those things that you just talked about. I mean, historically bad injuries for this
generationally bad injury luck.
Yeah, I mean, legitimately. And I know opposing fans don't ever want to give that sort of credit to an organization, and it seems like, oh, that's just excuses, but I think they are legitimate excuses. And so what would that mean in your own words, Lindsay, on if the Braves do pull this off, not the division, but just getting to the postseason with the roster that they have, offensively, defensively, pitching staff? I mean, I think that would be remarkable.
Fans may not agree. Betting markets haven't agreed as of yet, but I think that's something where you have to consider Brian Snitker for manager of the year. Honestly,
really,
I think it's
no way they give it to him.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. They always pick the best team who surprised the most. It's going to be probably the Brewers, or it's, you know, and then probably the Royals in the American League. But I think that it's a manager of the year caliber job by Snitker to even get them there through all the injuries.
More to come with our baseball power hour, looking around Major League Baseball, who's in, who's out, and what's up for grabs. We got 30 more minutes in hour number one on our baseball power hour. Don't go anywhere.
On the line with Jacob Goetz on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader.
Halfway through hour number one here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line on ESPN 106.7. Full house on this Tuesday afternoon. I'm Jacob Goetz. He is Christian Griffin. We also got Lindsey Crosby in the studio as well for our baseball power hour. And Lindsey, looking around Major League Baseball, as we're less than 30 games away from the end of the regular season, postseason is next month, October baseball, right around the corner, right? You look around all of the different division races, and yes, the Braves in the NL East has started to get separated a little bit. Second and third is what's up for grabs. We talked about that a moment ago, but if you had to kind of highlight a couple of other division races that have caught your eye, ones that very well could come down to the wire, where do we need to look?
One that I thought was going to get sewn up pretty easily has become dramatic is the AL Central. I had the Royals just coming in and just taking over, beating Cleveland. Cleveland was in a slump. The Royals were hot. But the Royals lost Vinny Pascantino to a broken wrist. He says he's coming back this year. He's not even had the surgery yet. That's not happening. Matt Quatro, the manager. I think he's the manager of the year in the American League. Stepping away for personal reasons. We don't know why. Personal, I'm not going to ask. And then Yuli Gurriel. They trade for Yuli Gurriel from the Braves to replace Pascantino. He leaves the game with a hamstring injury. They have lost their last six games. They are 3-7 in their last 10. The Twins are now 3.5 games back of Cleveland. Cleveland is 6-4 in their last 10 games. And it's like it's looking like this could be kind of interesting down the stretch. And then the usual Yankees versus Orioles. Who's going to win this division? The loser's the first wild card. There's not a lot of drama.
Don't count out the Red Sox.
The Red Sox are 4.5 of the wild card. They absolutely could make a run. They have to pass one of those three teams. They have a chance at chasing down the Royals.
Stop.
Simply because the Royals have struggled so much. They have the 8th hardest schedule left in baseball. The Royals do. They got to take on the Yankees 3 times. Cleveland, Minnesota still, the Braves, the Tigers. You may be a Braves fan that final weekend of the year. Because the Boston, who, by the way, 18th hardest schedule, Boston may be able to slip in if they can handle their business down the stretch, and Kansas City keeps losing, especially if they can lose that final series to Atlanta. They may fall out of the postseason, which still an amazing year for Kansas City. They lost 100 games last year. To be in the postseason as of right now in September, a year after losing 100 games, is amazing.
What does the Red Sox remaining schedule look like home and away? Because the Red Sox play much better on the road somehow. They are 31-38 at home. They're 39-30 away from Fenway Park.
Which has been so crazy. That's been a growing trend the last couple of years with the Red Sox. I don't understand it. Like, they, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lindsey, I mean, we've been a better team on the road the last handful of years than at Fenway Park. I just don't get it. And on the road, we're in New York right now with the Mets. You still have a road trip against the Yankees, I believe, is on there. And then maybe Toronto?
Yeah, you've got, so you have, I just had it here to go. You've got road trips to the Yankees, the Rays, and Toronto. You've got home. You have the Rays again at home. You have the Twins at home, the Orioles at home, the White Sox at home. You are at the Mets right now. The thing that I've never really understood about the Boston Red Sox in the last couple seasons is it feels like you're not doing a great job of optimizing the ballpark. The pesky pole down the right field line, those are some of the shortest home runs in all of baseball, like almost universally. And yet there's so many of these guys that are not getting in the pull hitting like you think they should. And a lot of these regulars that you see end up, like, they're lefties. I'm sorry, Tristan Casas, lefty. Raffy Devers, lefty. David Hamilton's on the IL, but like Emmanuel Valdez, lefty. You look in your outfield, Willie Abreu, lefty. Jaron Duran, lefty. Masataka Yoshida, lefty. But yet, they're not pulling the ball enough to take advantage of that. I feel like the Red Sox have way too many guys that like to go opposite field. And it's like, what are you doing?
I'm with you, man. Believe me. Like,
I'm trying to hit my stand-up single off the green monster.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense to me, man. It really doesn't. Hey, by the way, if anybody wants more baseball coverage and stuff after we're done here on the show today, ESPN put out a really, really good stat article today, Lindsay. I don't know if you saw this either. Just percentage to make the playoffs and get to certain rounds and in, wild card, things like that. So people can go and check that out. Now, we're all keeping up with the Red Sox. Don't worry. Everybody here is a huge, huge Boston fan. I know
yes,
they are.
I'm a massive Boston fan.
How many teams... A question for you, Lindsay. I know the one that comes to mind immediately is Juan Soto. Getting a guy that fits your ballpark. Obviously, with the short porch in right field with the Yankees, Juan Soto being that lefty hitter you talk about, how many teams are starting to continue to put a focus on the tendencies of hitters as well as complementing them with their ballpark?
I think the AL East has been the best at this. Baltimore likes to go get lefty position players. And obviously, left field in Baltimore, they call it Baltimore now. It's so deep in left field.
Well, they moved it back 20 feet, didn't they, or something
they
like
pushed
that.
It back 20 feet, and they raised the wall up vertically as well.
Oh, I didn't know they did that.
And so it plays a lot deeper than it used to.
Wow.
And so they've stocked up on lefties in their farm system. And, like, the flip side of this is I think the Tyler O'Neill move, I mean, he pulls the ball 50% of the time, okay? But a lot of these guys just, like, Jaron Duran goes opposite field more than he goes pull.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are we doing? So many of these guys, it's not the right mix for the ballpark. And I think that is one of the areas teams are hesitant to change their ballpark for the purposes of getting offense or suppressing offense, but they're getting better at customizing what they do.
Right.
And I think Baltimore's a great example of that. A lot of teams now are trying to make their ballparks not be so extreme for pitchers. We used to see a lot of pitchers' parks. I feel like the 90s were a big time of getting a lot of pitchers' parks, 80s and 90s. And as you replace ballparks now, they're making them more hitter-friendly. But not enough teams customize their lineup for their guys. I think Baltimore only has two guys. I'm sorry, Baltimore. Boston only has two guys that pull more than 50% of the time, which should kind of be a prerequisite in that ballpark. Like
you would think.
That is why Adam Duvall was so good there last year. When he started, he was incredibly hot to start the year because he's a massive pull hitter. Yes, he's a righty, but he's pulling down the line and he's hitting the top of the monster for everything.
Yeah.
Like finding guys that have outlier traits and using those to your advantage, it kind of feels like that's really the next kind of money ball thing that smart teams are doing.
Yeah.
Finding guys who are outlier at something and finding a way to use that to your advantage. Baltimore's good about it with their hitters. I feel like the Rays are good at that with their pitchers for the most part. Same thing the Dodgers, but that's just guys who are injured a lot. They get them for cheap because their guys are hurt a lot. You just don't see a lot of that with teams like Boston. Like there's a lot of lefties. Yes, you should find a lot more guys that are pulling the ball though. And it's not lefties who pull, which is weird to me.
You talked about the Orioles being a team that's done it really well with their lefties. One of their lefties, Auburn phenom legend Gunnar Henderson, hit, I believe it was number 34 that tied Cal Ripken and is it Miguel Tejada for the most home runs in a season for an Orioles shortstop. So again, just a perfect example of one of those young lefties that they got. I know they have plenty of other ones. Heston Kierkegaard.
Kirsten.
Yeah.
Yes. Heston Kirsten.
And then
I think Colton Cowles was a lefty as well. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, but I think Colton Cowles is a lefty. Like they and then their farm system. One of them, just, their farm system's full of it too.
Yes.
Speaking of crazy stats, a guy we haven't talked about yet today that we almost always talk about because you have to when you talk about Major League Baseball. 50-50 watch for Ohtani. I mean, it's insane to see what he's doing. I don't know if it's going to happen, but...
Well, like, we make the joke, we don't know if it's going to happen. I got an email today from an unnamed sportsbook. They don't pay me enough to say their name, but I got an email from a sportsbook today.
Attaboy. Don't you dare sell out. You get your
no
money.
Free, like,
dang it.
No,
it
was, free pub.
No free pub.
It was my sportsbook.
No free pub.
I just tried to throw it in.
But they will Shohei Ohtani become a member of the 50-50 club? They have yes at minus 225, which
wow.
is a really nice
wow.
69.2% probability that it's going to happen.
Nice, nice.
And it's, it come on. I mean, this has been absurd. He swiped three bags last night, 46 bags, 44 homers. He has 24 games left to hit six homers. So one every four games. It is, that is outside of his career pace, but that is absolutely doable. You pop off for two homers in one game, this is done.
What's his current pace this season? What's he doing, about one every three games, two and a half maybe?
There's no way. Well, actually, no, there might be a way.
I don't know what it is off the top of my head. I'm just guessing he's pushing for 50 this year, and he has 24 games left.
Hang on. All right, he is, his homer percentage this season, I have it right here, is 7.1%. It is actually lower than his MVP seasons in 21 and 23. He had a 7.2% in 21, 7.4% in 23. He's at 7.1% this year,
which puts him at
pace for 49.
Jeez.
But wow. Again, you pop off for two in one game, and
you've
got
it. Which we know he's capable of.
We know he's capable of doing it.
Absolutely capable. I mean, it's truly remarkable to see, and it was 40-40 when he hit the walk-off grand slam, right? That's how he did that for 40-40.
That's how he got 40-40, right? I mean, it's one of those things, like, Marcel Ozuna could win the Triple Crown, but he's probably not going to get there for home runs, and either way, it's definitely going to be a Shohei Ohtani MVP, barring some sort of generational collapse. Like, he would have to not get a hit in the next 24 games, and Ozuna would have to go nuts and get the Triple Crown, I think, to pass him. And I just don't see it happening.
So, college football fans, get ready for your Saturday to be split screen like it was last year with Aaron Judge. So, when Shohei's at 49 home runs and 51 stolen bases, and it's halfway through the third quarter of LSU and Ole Miss, you're going to watch Shohei Ohtani try and hit number 50.
Is my math correct? He's averaging a homer every three games, 44 homers and 152 games played, or 135 games played. Is that right?
Roughly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So
that would make sense, because I saw he was averaging 0.08 home runs per at bat this year. So almost one out of every 12 plate appearances. So
yeah,
one out of every two and a half, three games. Man, you're good at that.
Now Aaron Judge is at 51 homers, and the odds are, from this unnamed sportsbook, that he will not get 63 homers. No is minus 250. Yes is plus 170. But come on. It's just, it is nuts here. This is blows my mind.
When you click on the Dodgers on ESPN and you go to their batting stats, across the top, it's Shohei Ohtani for all of the categories except one, and it's Freddie for OBP. Everything else is Shohei. Batting average, homers, RBIs, hits, it's all Shohei Ohtani. He is the leader of that team offensively, and it's not close.
And that's with Shohei having a quote-unquote subpar month of August, to where, because I believe before August he was hitting well into the 300s and now is down to 292 or 294, somewhere around that. But just the fact that you can have a quote-unquote slump for Shohei Ohtani and still be almost hitting 300.
In the month of August, he hit only 235.
Yeah.
Interesting trend, though. His batting average has gotten worse in every month this season.
Really?
336 in April, 312 in May, 293 in June, 286 in July, 235 in August. He's only played two games this month, so it's not relevant. He's batting 250, but it's like 2-for-8. So.
Lights are too bright for him. That's what it is. He can't handle the spotlight.
Wait till October when plays his first ever playoff game goes over 4.
Which is such a crazy
stat
right there, that Shohei is about to play in his first ever playoff series.
Is it crazier that the Los Angeles Angels had Shohei Ohtani and Mike Trout and never sniffed the postseason? They had two MVP years from Shohei Ohtani, and they had Mike Trout.
And
they never sniffed the postseason. I'd argue slightly behind.
Yeah, that's fair.
He had injury concerns, but still.
That's fair.
Never sniffed the postseason.
Shohei has scored 109 runs for the Dodgers. The next best player on the Dodgers is Freddie Freeman with 74.
Yeah. Now, in Shohei's defense, both Freeman and, or, yeah, in Shohei's defense, or the Dodgers' defense, both Mookie and Freddie missed time. Freddie hasn't missed a ton of time, but Freddie did miss time. I want to know the world that exists where the Dodgers don't make the postseason. The playoff odds are 99.9%. I want to see that one in seven million.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, they'd have to lose out
every single game and have both the Padres and the Diamondbacks run it. And, you know, one of them take the division and then the Mets come up and take a postseason spot behind Atlanta. And
not happening.
It would just be wild to see, wouldn't it? Like, the generational collapse.
It's crazy, too, looking at it. You just mentioned Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani. They played 6 years together, so by math, that's 972 games. They played 449 games together through both of their injuries. So a crazy thought of how the two of them never even thought about, as you mentioned, sniffing the postseason, even getting Anthony Rendon, who was a disaster in Anaheim. Crazy that the two of the greatest players that could go down as a competition for the best players to ever play the game We'll never have a game together in the postseason.
Yeah, played about, what, that averages to 2.5 seasons, give or take, something like that. I mean, it's not very long, not very long for them at all. And so Shohei continues to do crazy things, and we will continue to talk baseball when we come back. And we'll wrap up our Baseball Power Hour with a big question for Lindsay on the postseason. We know the bracket as of now, but which team that's in won't be come the start of the postseason. We'll have that for you as we wrap up hour number one after this.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7, online at ESPNAU.com or on the ESPN 106.7 app.
Wrapping up hour number one, also wrapping up our Baseball Power Hour. Boo.
Sad face.
Play the hotkey.
I still don't have it in here yet. I know. I need it. We used to have the money hotkey in here. We need to get that one back. We need to put the boo or the crowd or the cheering.
Aww.
Yeah, that one. We need to have that one in here.
I know that this is mostly baseball, almost entirely baseball. Did you see the fake punt from the high school over the weekend?
No.
So they are lined up on fourth down in a punt formation, and the punter catches the ball, and then he underhand chucks it in the air, so the path of the ball mimics a punt. And so the opposing team, like, two of their guys run down there, and so the opposing team's, like, backing up to let it hit the ground.
And then somebody
and he catches comes underneath it, and it's a first down.
No way.
No way.
Yeah, because, like, it was just something where...
What?
Like, it was... They know the opposing team didn't watch the ball actually get kicked. They just looked up and saw the motion,
which is what most people do. Like, most players will not watch the actual punt, which is why you see all the time you'll have two people back there. The one guy will fake catching it and take off, and then the other guy's just sprinting down the sidelines. No, I'm looking that up during the break. That's phenomenal if that's the case.
Like, it was Thomas Downey High School. No idea where they are, but that was amazing. It was so cool.
I don't even know how to look that up. Fake
what
punt
a great
pass,
idea.
High school football?
Here
I don't
we go.
Know.
I'm going to try and...
Yeah.
Anyway, while we're looking that up, and we'll watch that during the break, I teased Lindsay before we get out of here. As of right now, and you'll be with us for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But as of right now, and I'm going to ask you this every week because the answer may change.
Yeah.
As of right now, we are less than a month away from the postseason. First game of the postseason is October 1st. Is there a team in the postseason, as we speak today on September 3rd, that you believe will not be in the playoffs?
Kansas City Royals. They have the last wild card spot in the AL, but they just keep getting hit with these injuries. They went, they got some outfielders. They claim Tommy Pham on waivers. They claim Robbie Grossman on waivers. I think it was a good move because they've had bad outfield production all year. But losing your first baseman, losing Vinny Pascantino, and then losing his replacement as well, and your manager having to walk away for personal reasons temporarily. We don't know, again, what it's for, how long it is. Mm-hmm. I just no longer have the faith that Kansas City has the consistent production to make the to hold on to that final postseason spot, especially with their schedule being as hard as it is.
Yeah, they are. Where do they stand as of right now, Kansas City, with their playoff situation?
So
I'm looking at it right now.
Final wildcard spot. They are a game behind the Twins for the second spot, but they're a game out, but one of the hardest schedules down the stretch. And right now, the Boston Red Sox are 4.5 out. they could theoretically do it if their guys would start pulling the dang ball at home.
You just want to come back on my show. I understand. I understand. Is your volume on this, Christian?
No. Surprisingly, behind that, the Detroit Tigers and the Seattle Mariners are both 5 and 5.5 games out. So one of those teams could do it. But
I'm watching.
We're watching the fake punt right now.
Isn't it great?
But it's funny that because there's amazing. Like three guys that were on the front line of defense, and they all have their arms up. Like, what is?
No
what
way.
Is
yeah,
he does. He just. Oh my!
They're gonna let it bounce. They're gonna let it bounce,
and they just—I awesome.
Mean—they don't even try to catch it.
I mean, is that a tight end that they put down there and just let him go after it? That's unbelievable. Nope. Yeah, they don't even come after it. Oh, that's sad.
They're gonna let it bounce.
Oh, that's.
All I know is Lee Scott ran a fake punt against Excel. I'll give my Warriors the edge over that one.
This was pretty bad. That's pretty terrible. Well, Lindsay, we always appreciate you, my man. Plug everything. Tell people where they can find you for all of your wonderful baseball coverage.
I'm on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. You can read all of the writing, bravestoday.com. That's our Substack. You can follow the podcast. There's two, Braves Today on YouTube and First Pitch on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. Appreciate you and your time as always, my man. Baseball Power Hour in the books. Stick around. Hour number two coming up. Christian and I will talk college football. Florida State, done. Season's over. I called it yesterday, and they embarrassed themselves on national television again last night. We'll talk about that, get reactions more from week one for Auburn, and begin to look ahead to week two. All that coming up in hour number two.
An Auburn Network production.
You are on the line. Live on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader. Online at ESPNAU.com or on the ESPN 106.7 app. To be on the line, call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502. You are on the line with Jacob Goins.
You're on the line here on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika sports leader. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope you're doing well as we get underway in hour number two here on ESPN 106.7. I'm your man, Jacob Goins. If you missed any of the first hour, it was our Baseball Power Hour. We do it every week during baseball season with our man, Lindsey Crosby. Check him out at Crosby Baseball on X. That's social media, formerly known as Twitter. So go check him out. He's got a lot going on. Podcasting, written work, all that good stuff. He's with us in the first hour every Tuesday here during On the Line. So that'll be in the podcast later. You can go and catch up with that. Major League Baseball, Atlanta Braves, division races, all that good stuff. A jam-packed hour number one. Here in hour number two, talking a lot of college football as week one is finally over. They drug that thing out as far as they could, I'll tell you what. So we have a lot more reactions from that. Get some of Christian's thoughts from Auburn in week one. And a new AP poll is out today too, so we can react to that as well. And you can get in on the show a couple of ways. You can call in at 334-321-1390, or you can shoot us a text in the on-the-line text box at 334-784-1067. And before we get to the phone lines, I want to remind you that hour number two, each and every day here during On the Line, is brought to you by the Orthopedic Clinic. The Orthopedic Clinic is East Alabama's go-to center for orthopedic care with locations in Auburn and Opelika to better serve you. You can find them online at theorthoclinic.com. So we appreciate them bringing you the 3 to 4 o'clock hour each and every day here on ESPN. 334-321-1390. Terry, thanks for holding on through the break, man. You're on the line.
Hey, Jacob. Hey, Chris. How y'all doing today?
Doing good.
Great. Guys, I've got a feeling that Auburn, because of the lack of success in the passing game, is going to turn to a passing school to a degree. Now, their bread and butter is still the running game. We all know that. But they've been so bad for so long, and to keep the recruitment up and to keep guys wanting to stay here, because you know you got to recruit them every year. They could leave after 1 year unless you're going to Clemson, of course, because they don't recruit the portal. But true. But receivers and quarterbacks who Hugh Freeze tends to go out and get, they're going to have to throw. They can throw the ball down if it was success. Now I know Alabama A&M is guys were getting separation for a reason, but they only scored 14 points last year against Cal, and they were lucky to get that.
You're right.
For Rivaldo Fairweather.
And I'll jump in on that because I think yes that Auburn. We can all agree that they needed to reestablish the passing game because it just has not been there consistently in so long. But Terry, look around college football. I mean, that's what the game is. I mean, it's more of a passing game now than it's ever been before. And
yeah, I mean, if you're not a quarterback, you're not going to win the Heisman Trophy.
That's why they've called it the new quarterback award. I mean, it's been quarterback heavy for so long, and it's off. The game is so offensive, and that's what's flashy is throwing the ball around, going up and down the field quickly, putting up as many points as you can, and passing does that better than running most of the time. So as long as Auburn doesn't forget that they're running. Is their core, and you still have to have a good running game. Yeah, I tend to agree that Auburn could become or might become a passing school.
Do you guys happen to know who the last quarterback to win the Heisman was? Or non-quarterback to win the Heisman, excuse me?
It'd be Devontae Smith at Alabama,
yeah.
Correct?
Okay, yeah, I think so.
That's what I was thinking, but I wasn't sure.
You've got a handful of running backs in there, McCaffrey. You've got a couple. There's not many. I mean, most of them have been quarterbacks over the last decade plus.
Sure, it's been a quarterback-heavy award. Let's be honest about that.
Oh, yeah.
It just seems like that Auburn's leaning in that direction. Like I said, you got Cal come. They scored 14 points last year. Was lucky to get that. If they can put up, double-digit points, they're just leaning more to the high school athlete now. That's what they look to be, and they want to make the ESPN top 10. They want to be on SportsCenter.
Sure.
And the offense is the way to do it.
I totally agree. And now that Auburn has the receivers to do that, and after one game, seems that Peyton Thorne can be the quarterback to do it, yeah, I would expect Hugh Freeze to open it up a little bit.
Well, I'm not going to read too much into one game because I think Alabama A&M is basically a small school, but nothing against them. But we'll know more this week against California, and those guys are going to be the shot when they get to Alabama at 2:30 on Saturday in September.
I agree with that. Terry, great to hear from you, man.
Take care, guys.
Thanks so much. Terry joining us, 334-321-1390.
Yeah, going off of what Mr. Terry said, four non-quarterbacks have won the Heisman since 2000. So it is essentially the quarterback award. There's been...
Hold on, let me see. Hold on, let me see if I can name them. Mark Ingram.
Yes.
Devontae Smith, you gave us that one.
Yes.
McCaffrey did win, right?
He did not.
I knew that was wrong.
Yeah.
I forgot.
I wasn't
going to
say it.
He should have. So it was what? Ingram, Smith... It's another running back for sure. Obviously,
there's more running backs.
Did Derrick Henry win it?
He did.
And then
final one, big time hint, just got it back.
Ah, Reggie.
Yep.
Yeah, got it. Okay.
Other than that, it has been all quarterbacks.
It's a quarterback award, man. I mean, you've had a couple of defensive guys there that have at least made the ceremony, right? There in New York, but and I wish it wasn't that way. But to Terry's point, and kind of what we're talking about here is, look at the game, man. Like that's just where it's going.
It
quarterbacks
is.
Have all the power. They have all the control, as they should. But as the old saying goes, they get all the blame, but they get all the fame. And if things go well, then yeah, they're going to be there for the Heisman ceremony.
They definitely will. And again, as in today's college football, they should be. And I'll get to this point in just a moment, but I feel like a little bit of it could be coming back into the older type of football. We've seen it the past couple weeks with the teams that are playing Florida State. But again, we'll get to that here in just a minute. But going back to...
Oh boy.
The Auburn passing game and how they're becoming a passing school. I was talking with my parents last night. We went over there to go watch the game, and my dad was sitting there asking me, why did Auburn keep throwing the ball? And I think a really good point to highlight is I feel like when you pass the ball, especially in a game like the game on Saturday night, there's a less chance for injury as well, because there aren't as many guards pulling. There's not as much contact right at the line of scrimmage. The offense is more in pass protection, so they're not trying to get upfield. You're not going to have as many rolled ankles, things like that. So as weird as it sounds, as much as conservative as running the football is, when you go back to what every coach is stressing in the preseason of how you have to get guys to Saturday, I feel like it makes it a little bit of a safer route when you're throwing to one receiver and one cornerback rather than trying to include all 11 guys on the offensive side of the ball every single play.
I think it's a situational thing. I mean, yes, you can make the argument that there's less chance of injury, but I just think it really is situational. I think Auburn threw the ball a ton on Saturday because they could, because they wanted to prove and maybe shut some people up, maybe just say, hey, told you so type of thing. And again, I will preface this, as everybody else will, it's Alabama A&M, okay? That is known. We're not going to say it anymore. That is understood, okay? That Auburn played legitimately one of the worst programs in college football.
That it was, okay, this drive, it is Keandre. Ready, run straight.
Exactly. And so, knowing that, Auburn went in and said, let's establish it. Let's get comfortable. Let's get guys involved. Let's let Peyton Thorne feel good. And Hugh Freeze had some quotes this week and about how Peyton played well, but there were still things that he was frustrated with that he needs to get on him about. And he did on the sideline. I asked him about that on Monday, yesterday, during his
press.
On
the video board, too. We got to see it.
Saw it through my binoculars in the press box. But, yeah, and he made a joke saying his wife got on him, too, which is really funny. But – yeah, I just think in past years, right, you'd go into this game and it's like, man, I'm not excited for this. You know, Auburn's going to come in and run the ball. They're going to score, you know, 40 points. They'll hold the other team to less than 10 and they'll win and they'll walk away, right? And it seems like a waste of time, which is what I said going into the game on Saturday, not knowing Auburn was going to do what it did. But don't we feel so much better during the game and after the game? Saturday does not feel like a waste to me. Saturday was a very good presentation for Auburn. That was a really good four-quarter game, even though they were shortened in the second half. Like, I feel like Auburn got something out of the game on Saturday.
Sure.
Rather than, yeah, going through the motions, let's just run the ball, we'll throw it if we have to, and we'll respect the opponent and we'll get out and move on. Auburn got something out of this game on Saturday.
They definitely did, and it goes all the way back to just the style of the RPO. I mean, there were so many times where you were looking at breakdown coverages and they still had six or seven guys in the box. You had three receivers to the far side of the field, and there was a cornerback and a safety. So it's just a numbers game. And so, yes, Auburn took advantage of that, but you just continued to run the offense that you continued to run all of spring, all of summer, and now into the fall. So you're just continuing to get more and more comfortable in that type of system. I saw something that said, and it was very, very accurate, imagine the other two coaches before Coach Freeze. Auburn gets up by 21 in the first quarter. How many times do we go three and out by running the ball up the middle, beginning halfway through the second quarter?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it just turns into, yeah, the clock is moving fast. All of a sudden they score a touchdown. We kick a field goal. We kick a field goal in the third quarter. They score a late touchdown. All of a sudden we win 33-14 or whatever it is. And it's a game to where, oh, okay, we didn't show a lot because it was Alabama A&M. That being said, you felt like you didn't learn anything. You felt like you didn't gain anything. Opening up the offense, running the offense, while still being quote-unquote vanilla. It's the RPO. The RPO isn't something that you sit there and look at every little bit about. You can play quote-unquote vanilla because there's three different things you can do every single play.
Correct, which is what is great, and the RPO is never going away.
No.
Auburn will use that all season long, from now all the way through the Iron Bowl and beyond, whatever that may be. And so that's what I liked, was Hugh Freeze said, to hell with all that. He said, we're going to play.
Yes.
Let's come in here and see what we can do, and let's get comfortable. It's week one. Let's not dance around and pony around and just get in and out and clean football, whatever. No. And look at what everybody's talking about. Everybody outside of Auburn knew that Auburn had some talent on the offensive side. But you start looking, it's like, man, Auburn put up 73 points on Saturday. Man, Cam Coleman got in the end zone. Malcolm Simmons got in the end zone. Perry Thompson got in the end zone. KLS got in there twice. It's like, oh, they're good, right?
Yeah.
Not only are they there, but they're going to be used. And if nothing else, Auburn made them a threat on Saturday to everybody else they play, because now if you're Cal or Arkansas or whoever, you have to respect those guys, because Auburn proved on Saturday they will be used.
Unless you're Mike Norvell, you hear coaches talk all about how they make the biggest improvements from week one to week two. Because you're able to finally play somebody in a different uniform, you're playing different colors, You're playing with a true stadium environment, and all of a sudden you go to week two and you see so many different things changed or cleaned up. But if you're Auburn and you're just continuously run the ball 31 gut right behind center every single time from the third quarter on, it doesn't give you any chance to improve on what you've been working on the entire year. But instead, you go out there and run the offense that you've been running, again, all offseason. Mm-hmm. It allows you to have that frustration points that Coach Freeze was talking about, to where, yeah, thankfully, the first time he yells at Peyton Thorne isn't going to be halfway through the third quarter when Auburn goes 3-and-out in a 7-point game against Cal.
Right.
You can afford to get angry with him when Auburn's up 21-0 halfway through the first quarter.
And I compared it to Nick Saban yesterday, and I still stand by that, because how many times did he go viral on social media or on SportsCenter because he was chewing some kid out when they were up 60-0 right. against, you know, Missouri Tech? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what coaches are supposed to do. And I like the point that you have about how Auburn's been doing this all offseason, and so you get into the game and you hope, and I don't think it was, you hope it's not a culture shock because you just continue to do what you've been doing, yeah. rather than what has happened in the past where it's like, whoa, hold on, nope, hit the brakes, we're going to slow down,
yeah.
can't show too much.
We're up 2 touchdowns, we can't.
We got Cal next week, can't show them too much.
They don't want to scout anything.
And the good thing is, to Terry's point and to what we're talking about here, and I think Uncle T-Bone and I mentioned this yesterday, we know that Auburn can run the ball. We know Jarquez Hunter's back there. He proved it. He scored very early in
his
that
first
game.
Carry of the year.
Yeah, first carry, yeah. Jarquez Hunter's back there. Damari Alston's back there. Jeremiah Cobb had some good plays. And the only, I guess, question on that is, can the offensive line create the holes? But as far as we know, they can. And we know with that running back room in particular, you don't have to have a huge hole. Those guys can get to the outside. Auburn's not just going to line up and run down the middle and hope and pray that there's a hole there. Auburn can run the football. And so Freeze and the offense and Coach Nix were not worried, oh, let's establish the run. Let's just make sure we're good. Nope. They threw the ball time and time again.
And going back to what you're talking about, to where it's, yeah, we know that this running back crew can tote the football. Peyton is, again, so much quicker than everybody gives him credit for. I mean,
yep.
the first time that I think we truly saw it, we saw it a little bit against Samford last year, but that Georgia run halfway through the second quarter when they were backed up, haunted by their own end zone, and had a 60-something yard gain that completely flipped the field. I think that was the first true time where it was, oh, this guy can actually run a little bit. We saw it again against Alabama A&M, to where the offensive line doesn't necessarily have to play, I don't mean this in any sort of negative way, but you can quote-unquote miss an assignment every now and then because you have that RPO option, to where it is not Peyton Thorne taking the snap and just holding the football out, to where everybody and their mama know that Jarquez Hunter is getting the ball on a halfback carry off tackle.
Yeah. I think it goes to what Freeze was saying too throughout fall camp, was I want to see Peyton make the right decision.
Yeah.
And when he's got to get out, whether that is throwing the ball away or whether it's going to his second read other than the first, or whether it's, yeah, tuck that thing, take off, see what happens. And I don't think you're going to see it much, but you're going to see him pick up some really key first downs, or at least gain yardage back after a bad play or a penalty or whatever the case may be, and keep drives alive with his legs. And then it's the few times that Auburn calls a QB keeper. They call Peyton Thorne's number to keep the football, and nobody's going to see it coming,
no.
And it's going to be a surprise to a lot of people.
Again, it's one of those things to where if Peyton Thorne can run the ball, not including a scramble, but a true RPO, to where he keeps it because he likes the hole that the defense gave him better. If he can do that 8 to 10 times a game, even if it's on 1st and 10 and he picks up 6 yards, that is a 100% win in an RPO type system. Get you ahead of the chains, get you second and manageable. I mean, even if you do that once a drive, and it just makes it enough to where in the back of that defensive end's mind, he's having to question, is Peyton going to keep it? And then all of a sudden, that 1 second of hesitation allows Jarquez Hunter, Damari Alston, Jeremiah Cobb to get that hole right on the middle, or right in the middle of that offensive line. You go back to the game on Saturday And not only did you see it on the RPO side of things with the running the football, and again, you more so saw all four receivers run straight and him find whoever was open, but there were plenty of times, I think about it, it was the one of the drives where they were heading towards the south end zone away from the student section, but the cornerback was playing off on the lone receiver on the far side, and he simply had an RPO and threw an 8-yard out route on first down. It turned into second and two, and just like that, I mean, if you can do that, and it's what he's been, it's what Coach Freeze has been telling him, yep, that he's all he needs to do.
Winning plays. All it is.
Simple game, plays. Right? What a simple game.
It really is, especially for guys that sit in the studio and talk about it into a microphone every day. 334-321-1390. John, hang on. You'll be first up when we come back here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7. Call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502.
Let's get to the phone lines once again. 334-321-1390. John in Auburn, you're on the line, man. What's up?
Hey, guys. Happy Tuesday. I have kind of a question and a comment for y'all. And,
okay.
And just wanted y'all's take on both these.
Sure.
First of all, one thing I'm looking for Saturday against Cal, I thought, I mean, it's hard to nitpick in a 70-point win. I thought our pass defense for Auburn Saturday kind of left a little out there. And with no turnovers for us, I don't know if it'll be different with Keontae Scott in there, but I would love to see some turnovers this week against Cal. I think that's something that going into SEC play, Auburn's going to have to create. And secondly, I just had a comment. I don't know if y'all saw it. The only game I saw it in was the LSU game. Did you guys see where if the defensive line makes a line shift,
yes,
like they all move over, it's a defensive delay of game penalty.
Yep.
And I'm real interested to see how consistently that gets called moving forward.
Yeah, that I saw that too, and I'd forgotten about it. And I mean, I don't know how much I like it. I understand why, because, yeah, in the past you could see the entire defensive line move, and most of the time it would cause the O-line to move. I mean, that's obviously why they would do it. I guess it makes it a little bit more fair, if you will, but I think that's just going to become an adjustment, and once teams make that adjustment, I don't see it being that big of a deal, but I do question, like you are, how much they're actually going to keep track of that and call that. In terms of Auburn pass defense, John, Freeze talked about how the linebackers struggled when dropping back in zone coverage, and I think that had a lot to do with it. There were some open holes. I think there were better one-on-one plays on the outside defensively in pass coverage, but I look for that to be cleaned up this week.
Agreed, and I mean, I don't know how many 70-point wins you can have and be minus two in the turnover category. One thing I noticed, though, just with Auburn's explosive pass game, and I'll leave on this note, it just seemed like the margin of error for Auburn this year with a healthy pass game, it's just so much more than it was last year. Last year it felt like, you know, 3-3 and outs and you were cooked.
I agree. I agree with that. And, John, great to hear from you, man. Thanks so much for the call. And it's funny you say that, John, because Christian and I were talking about that during the break. I can't remember who told me or who said it, or where I got this from, so I'm not taking credit for this, but I think college football teams are averaging 7 possessions per game right now through week one. That's what you're getting every game because of the time changes, the rule changes, all of that. You're getting 7 possessions per game on average. And yeah, if you go 3 and out and 3 of those score a touchdown on 2 and field goals on 2, you're at, what, 14, 17, 20 points. That's not enough to win a football game most of the time. And so, John is right. In the past, Auburn, yeah, their room for error was very, very minimal because of the competition, the difference in talent, the people they were playing. I mean, all of that went into it, and I think John's exactly right.
Yes, I would agree. I think something, yes, you look at the turnover margin, but the biggest thing for me was the defense being able to get off the field, because those, to me, count just as much as turnovers do. 3 for 18 combined on third and fourth down was Alabama A&M. And yes, I know you just prefaced it. it was the Alabama A&M offense. But the ability to get off the field on third down and long was something that Auburn struggled with a lot last year. And so being able to look at that, I think, gives a lot of confidence. You expect those turnovers to be able to come eventually in certain scenarios. You don't necessarily count the blocked punt for a touchdown as a turnover, but something like that creates a turnover-type play. And going back to the passing game for Auburn, you talk about the margin of error. No pun intended, it's a lot larger because last year Auburn's top two receivers were 5'9". And you look at it right now, Perry Thompson 6'3", Camden Brown 6'3", Keandre Lambert-Smith 6'1", Cam Coleman 6'3". You just go down the list. I mean, even Malcolm Simmons at 6 foot, Bryce Kane is 5'10", Rivaldo Fairweather 6'4". So quite literally, no pun intended, the margin of error for Peyton Thorne to throw the ball is a little bit wider just because of the catch radius. And what a great thing it is to be able to say that Peyton Thorne does not have to hit the guy in the face mask or on the front shoulder pad for a guy to be able to go make a grab.
And there were still a couple of drops on Saturday.
There were.
So keep that in mind too. And in terms of the turnovers for Auburn, I mean, they were very late in the game, both of them in the second half of the fourth quarter. And I asked Hugh Freeze about that in the postgame presser, and he wasn't happy about it. He said, look, I don't care what unit we're playing, what time it is, and what the score is, we expect you to hold on to the football, because both of them were fumbles. They were fumbles caused late in the game, and he was not happy about it, because that could have been all, because I asked this, Auburn had only 5 penalties, which isn't bad, and they had 2 turnovers. And I asked him, I said, is that the type of clean football you're looking for? And he basically said, that's not good enough.
No, and again, it shouldn't be, because like what you were talking about, the reference with Coach Saban, where it's 53-3 halfway through the fourth quarter, but you're getting onto a guy for a holding penalty that wasn't needed. If you create an environment to where, it's okay, we were up by 63 points at that time, it's okay that you turn the ball over, then it's going to create that mentality of acceptance and accepting anything but everybody's best throughout the game, regardless of the score.
Auburn wasn't the only team that played in week one. Tons more reactions to come, including the Noles. Oh my gosh. Who's in a worse predicament right now? Florida State at 0-2 or their counterpart Florida at 0-1? Lots more to come here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. Stick around.
With Jacob Goetz on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader.
30 more minutes here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line on the Auburn Opelika sports leader. I'm Jacob Goetz. Christian Griffin with us in the studio. And nice job Friday night, by the way. The Warriors go on the road. Lochapoca and the Warriors 2-0 in the AHSAA. How about that?
Yeah, it was a very different game than week one. It was a very defensive battle, you could say. Neither team played very well. I believe there were 9 total turnovers between the two teams. Not a single point scored in the second half. It felt like it was a 30-to-30-yard line type game. But again, in a couple weeks from now, and even looking at it right now, a sloppy win is a whole lot better than a pretty loss. And I think that every coach, every fan, every player will tell you that 2-0, regardless of how poor you play in a certain week, to be able to go into a tough environment, win on the road, you'll happily take that any day of the week.
Yeah, you were telling me Friday that there were a lot of, and we figured this would be the case, there's a lot of Lochapoca fans out there.
Oh, man. Yeah.
They love their Indians now. They showed up, and yeah, credit to Lee Scott. I know there's a classification difference there. Lee Scott 3A, Poca 1A, right? I think
yes.
Lochapoca 1A, and so but still, I mean, first road game of the year, and now Lee Scott opens up region play, and they got the Tigers of Childersburg this week on the road back-to-back.
Yes, all the way up at Childersburg. We believe the stream will be good to go on Friday because we know it's a little bit of a further drive, so we believe that everything will be good on that setup. Make sure to join us on AU100 pregame starting at 6:30, kickoff at 7 on Friday night.
And it's no secret about what week it is around here. It is Auburn and Opelika for high school football this week. And so we are continuing to keep an eye and just hoping, praying, I think, as well, that the rain somehow goes away, holds off something. I don't know. If the Lord could just, you know, kind of snap his fingers and make that go away for a day or so, I'd be okay with that. That'd be fine. It's supposed to be kind of bad on Friday.
It is. It is. I believe that it was down to 80% here, 60% now in Childersburg, where it was like 80 or 90%. So it looks like it could be going away a little bit, or possibly being pushed up later in the day.
We're down to 81%. Here we go.
There we go.
Here we go.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Well, here's the problem. The only thing that would make it good is if it goes up to Thursday, because we don't want it to rain Friday for high school football.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Don't get pushed back.
And, yeah, I don't want it to rain Saturday for Auburn and Cal. How miserable would that be?
It can keep the cool weather, though. I would be okay with a mostly cloudy 2:30 kickoff in Jordan-Hare.
It's supposed to be 74 degrees on Friday.
Man.
74. Oh, man. Well, keep an eye out on that. And the rain also, because as Uncle T-Bone and I announced yesterday, we're on location Friday. We are at a Plaza Bar and Lounge. We're normally outside on the Plaza patio. Yeah. If it is raining, I believe we have enough room inside that we can get set up down there. That's brought to you by Sensi Green Heating and Air. So Friday's a busy day around here with between ESPN being on location, Auburn High School hosting Opelika, and Lee Scott on the road at Childersburg. So that's all coming up on Friday. We'll continue to shout all that out, preview that as we go along. Week one of college football is officially in the books, thanks to Florida State showing themselves again on TV last night. National TV, no other college football games on. Everybody in the world watching as Mike Norvell and the Noles go 0-2.
Yeah, starting
gross.
Starting their season at home. I don't know how you get it that priority pick to where you now have the very first game of the year in a different continent, and then you're able to somehow get the lone game on a Monday Labor Day. I don't know how you get both of those, but
they may not get it.
I was
going
to say Florida State is regretful that they were able to get those because as bad as both of those losses were, it wasn't even that you could hide under any other possible games. You can't hide under Vanderbilt and Virginia Tech. Nope. Everybody and their mama sitting there eating cheeseburgers and hot dogs, watching Boston College run all over your defensive front four.
I mean, it really is hard to put it into words because Boston College went back to the basics. Let me tell you what, they went back to the basics because of who their head coach is. And I think it was a masterful game plan for what BC did. They ran the football. They ran it some more. And then when they got tired of that, they ran it some more. It didn't matter. And the few times they didn't run it, Christian, all they did was just toss it to the running back who peeled out of the backfield, and Florida State looked like they'd never seen it before.
No, I mean, it could have been a 3rd-and-8 draw that went for 15 and another first down, and Boston College said, okay, we're going to use all 40 seconds on first down. We're going to use 39 and a half seconds on second down. And we'll use 38 on third down. And then we'll pick up the 3rd-and-2 to pick up another first down. I believe Florida State had the ball for under a minute of time of possession in the first quarter. They ran three plays, went 3 and out. And Boston College scored early, closing out their first drive of the second quarter. Castellanos was 10 of 16 for 106 yards, the Boston College quarterback. But I believe, I could be wrong, I believe it was either a single digit or it was not much more than 10 or 15 yards passing that he had in the second half.
I would believe it. And they didn't have to. They just ran the football. Their offensive and defensive line, but especially their offensive line, dominated Florida State. And it's so crazy because we talked about this a week ago with the Georgia Tech game. That Florida State defensive line preseason was getting NFL draft hype, like one of the best defensive lines possibly ever in terms of defensive talent for the NFL. And here we are 2 weeks in, and they've been embarrassed both times. And then you flip over to the offensive side, and can we finally just all agree that DJU is not it? Can we all agree that he's not the answer? And the fact that Dabo Swinney won double-digit games with him as a starting quarterback may be the best coaching job in the history of college football. I mean, he couldn't hit anything. Nothing. He was a deer in headlights at home in Tallahassee. They were booing. They were chanting the backup's name. They were done with DJU and Florida State. I said it yesterday. Their season was on the line last night against Boston College. They're the first top 10 team to lose the first two games since I think Florida State did it a few years ago. I think they're done. I think Florida State is the first team eliminated from the college football playoff in 2024.
Unless I did do a very quick play-by-play search of the second half drives. So I could be somewhat incorrect, but from what I saw, Thomas Castellanos went 1 for 3 in the second half for 4 yards.
I love it. I love it.
Threw for 106 total yards. The team ran for 263 yards. They were at 270 before the kneel downs. They averaged 5.1 yards a carry throughout the entire game.
Florida State had 11 possessions offensively. Are you ready for what they did? Punt, punt, fumble, field goal, interception, punt, touchdown, turnover on downs, punt, and punt. In those last couple punts, they waved the white flag. They were done. In Boston College, they won 28-13, but Bill O'Brien being the NFL guy that he is, and they talked about this on the broadcast last night, they were inside, what, the 10? They had goal to go.
They got down to the 4.
And they knelt it out.
Yes.
They could have scored another touchdown. This thing could have been 35-13.
And even if it was 35-13, even if I watched the game and didn't see the score bug on the bottom, I don't know if I would have believed you that it was only 35-13.
Yeah.
Much less a 28-13 game, because Boston College just absolutely dominated. Again, their offensive line dominated that front seven of the rushing attack, dominated the offense or the defensive line of Florida State. Castellanos didn't have to drop back many times, but when he did, I mean, bring your sleeping bag.
Like,
bring your sleeping bag. There was nobody there getting pressure whatsoever. And the few times that he had to roll out, the defense was in zone or the defense was in man. Let me go ahead and break off 18, just scampering through the pocket. And then let me go use another minute and 20 seconds. That second drive for Boston College explains the game as a whole. And this is what I was talking about after Mr. Terry's call about how I can see certain times the game going back and going away from that crazy passing attack. A 14-play, 71-yard drive that took up 9 minutes and 18 seconds.
It's magical.
And on a road team where you feel like you have the strength in that department, why drop back and throw the ball? Why would you not just abuse what your strength is and what through now 2 weeks you see Florida State's defense, their weakness? I mean, Haynes King didn't have to throw the ball too many times in the second half. You get a running quarterback option, it's all you need. I mean, literally, the wide receiver would come in motion and would stop inside the tackle box and would become another blocker on the inside. And they'd pick up 5 yards on first down. They'd pick up 4 yards on third down and pick up a first down on third down.
I've got to update my biggest loser. And I said I would do this. Dabo Swinney was my biggest loser in week one, unless Florida State lost.
Yeah.
Florida State's my biggest loser in week one. They're, unless a miracle happens and they win out on a brutal schedule, which they've shown us nothing on why they would, they've eliminated themselves from the college football playoff after 1 week, technically two, but after week one of college football. Like, and not just any Power Four team, a preseason top 10 team, Christian.
And a team that had all of the complaints at the end of last year by not making the 4-team playoff, felt all disrespected, a nice showing to start the 2024 campaign. 0-2, and again, it's not only 0-2, you're 0-2 in conference play.
Exactly.
It's not like it was Texas A&M who lost a game and didn't look great doing it, but in the grand scheme of things, it had zero correlation to their record as a whole, because you could still go, you can go 10-2, but you go 8-1 in conference play and everything's going to be looking okay. Instead, you start off with Georgia Tech and then Boston College, and again, unless something crazy happens to where Florida is just as worse than we possibly think, and that's what made Miami look so good, or if Clemson all of a sudden figures something out, which they won't, Florida State is done. in the ACC championship conversation, in the ACC automatic bid conversation. I mean, DJ Uiagalelei has been as underperforming as I say that, but it's just what he's done his whole career.
Exactly.
It's so, exactly what he did. I did see something. You talked about Dabo Swinney being the biggest loser. He somehow went 11-2 with that man.
Well, that's what I said just a second ago. Center. That's a great coaching job. That's unbelievable. I don't know how he did it. I really, really don't. And I think what this also proved, and not just this game, but many games this weekend, I think it proved that preseason rankings are – a 100% guess.
It is. It is 100% a guess. And I would, they would never in a million years happen, but I would love to possibly see rankings not even come out until you have the first college football playoff poll.
What, wait till mid-October?
Right, where teams are 7-1 or 8-2 or even 6-2 with a quality loss in there or whatever it may be. It would never happen because that's what gets everybody through the offseason is,
sure.
Oh, look, we're the 7th-ranked team in the preseason poll. But again, you have, and now with the transfer portal era, you have absolutely no idea what is going to truly come out of a team, and it makes it to where, it. And again, this is not, almost a little bit of a shot at Notre Dame, but it feels like they had Texas A&M ranked highly up there, so that way Texas A&M, or that way Notre Dame could go in there and say, hey, at the end of the year, we went 11-1. We didn't play a conference game, but look at our ranked wins. We beat a ranked Texas A&M team on the road, when in reality, you wait until mid-October and Texas A&M is 4-4 at
which,
that point.
Which, for me, I don't even care. I don't care if A&M goes winless this year. I still gave Notre Dame credit for going and taking that game.
Yes.
Which is crazy because I never give them credit for anything. But
okay, so I guess I'm seeing the other way of things to where it's you're
oh, I get what you're saying.
You're giving a team a ranked win when that team could be 4-4 or even 5-3 at that point. But at the time, it was a high quality ranked win, and so for all you know, Boston College is going to be able to look at this game, and Florida State's going to go 3-9. I don't think they'll be that low, but it makes it to where the ranking so early on, like you said, they're such a guess. It's just a prediction, and you've seen through a week and a half how wrong it can be.
I'm not going to say they're worthless, but they're a guess is what it comes down to, and we don't know anything until we know. And it's, so that's what we've learned from college football.
It is strictly for conversation points in the offseason.
Entertainment purposes only.
Yes, that's all that it is. But that's what it feeds everybody, so they're not going to change anything.
Hey, let's us have a little bit more fun. We got to get to our final break here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. When we come back, we'll wrap it all up here on ESPN 106.7.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7, online at ESPNAU.com, or on the ESPN 106.7 app.
Winding down here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line on ESPN 106.7. Been an awesome show today, man. If you missed any of it, be sure you go and listen to the podcast. Lindsey Crosby was with us in hour number one for our baseball power hour. That was a lot of fun, and so that was in that first hour. And then here in hour number two, been a lot of Auburn football talk, been week one football talk. It's been great here on the Tuesday edition of the show, so we appreciate you being with us and tuning in. Again, if you missed any of it, you can go and listen to the podcast. Before we get out of here, I need to share our high school player of the week. We do this all season long. It's brought to you by the Orthopedic Clinic, who also brings you the second hour of the show today and every day from 3 to 4. But we pick a local high school football, basketball, and then baseball or softball player, whatever sport is going on. And this week's Orthopedic Clinic High School Player of the Week is Opelika High's Jamari Miller. The Bulldogs senior wide receiver, 3 total touchdowns last week, and including an 86-yard kickoff return to help Opelika defeat Callaway, a team out of Georgia. They beat them 48-13. And so, shout out to Jamari Miller. Congratulations to him, Orthopedic Clinic High School Player of the Week. We do our best to keep it local, but if there's somewhere, you know, kind of outskirts a little bit, we'll definitely show a little bit of love. So we appreciate the Orthopedic Clinic and wanted to share that with you. Jamari Miller from Opelika High is our Orthopedic Clinic Player of the Week. Got a text in the text box, Christian, about Auburn in particular. I want to read this before we get out of here. It says, last year we route, and talking about Auburn, we route UMass and look inept versus Cal. Then we pass well against Samford at home and feel like we're going somewhere, then disappear against Texas A&M, which I agree with all of that completely. And so he says, I think that's what makes the fan feel a little nervous, is what we saw real, but it felt different. We looked fast and prepared and ready to air it out. Wasn't like we beat them with 300 on the ground. I think that's spot on.
I think it's exactly spot on. And that was kind of what all three of our week one needs were. And I think all of them were met. Yours was for Auburn to not go out and make it look like it's week one for Auburn. Mine was so that way make the offense look like it has played before, make it a synchronized unit. And I think you saw a lot of that in week one. Again, it wasn't UMass to where we ran the ball for, 350 yards. And ever since halfway through the second quarter, it was ground and pound. Throw the ball every now and then. We'll throw the screen on 3rd and 11. To try and pick up the first down. It was the offense going out, again, doing what they've done the entire offseason and doing it at a very, very high level.
And I understand fans' concern of,
well, there should be, I feel like.
Well, I think that's fair. I mean, you can't just dive into week one, and this is crazy to say, even with, like, Georgia, right? I mean, even with what they did against Clemson, like, yeah, it looked good, but they should have a little concern of, will this carry over? Georgia has the reputation that they probably will, but there's probably a little bit of, all right, let's see if this sticks throughout the entire season.
Right.
For Auburn in particular, you don't want to dive in and say, man, this is going to be great. We're going to score 70 points a game. This is going to be awesome. If Auburn does, then great. But I get where Auburn fans are coming from. That's a traumatic pass. That
Very
is some PTSD
so.
Type of thing for Auburn fans, because we've seen this story before, and how they laid it out just now is exactly right. Auburn looked good, then looked bad against Cal, came back home against Samford, like, everything's fine, and then Texas A&M was a disaster.
Well, it's what you and Uncle T-Bone always talk about, that until Auburn doesn't Jabba, you can't necessarily trust them.
It's true.
To not Jabba.
Yeah.
Auburn will Auburn until they will not just Auburn be Auburn.
Jabba will Jabba. That's how it goes. So I'm with you on that. I absolutely am. And hopefully Auburn is able to show a little bit this weekend as well against Cal. A defense that Hugh Freeze very much respects. He was like that way last year, and he is still that way this year. Still a lot of question marks for that Cal team. And tomorrow on the show is when we flip the page and really start looking at week two. That's how we do it here during On the Line. We do Monday, Tuesday, full week breakdown from the past, and then Wednesday is the day that we flip the page. Tomorrow is Jordan Hill of Dogs 247. It's also Double D. Daryl Dapperts will be with us tomorrow as well. Thursday is busy, as it always is. Brad Law from the Auburn Sports Network. Auburn High's head football coach Keith Etheridge will join us. And then Chris Gordy of Locked On SEC. And Friday, we are out live on location at Auburn Plaza Bar and Lounge, brought to you by Sensa Green Heating and Air. Very excited for that. We will be out there talking all things college football, Auburn football, as the Tigers get ready to host Cal. We'll also talk a little high school football as well, with Auburn High hosting Opelika. And Lee Scott, you guys will be on the road at Childersburg. So that'll all coming up this week. Christian, appreciate you, man. Always a blast.
Always is. I'll see you Friday, if not any other time, with my schedule that is pretty much undetermined.
Yeah, I was about to say, anybody can keep up with your schedule, my man. You're all over the place. But appreciate you as always. Appreciate Lindsey Crosby in hour number one as well. Check out the podcast, ESPNAU.com. I'll post the show as soon as we're done here. Back tomorrow, Jordan Hill of Dogs 247 and Double D Wednesdays with Daryl Dapperich. That's coming up 2 to 4 right here on ESPN 106.7. Until then, I'm Jacob Goins. Stay safe. I'll talk to you later.